Hey guys, it's Brian Young of A Crash Course for the Ravers.
It's a crash course for the Ravers.
Where we play deep cuts, lost classics, live tracks, your requests, and plenty of local rock sprinkled throughout. I'm joined by my beautiful co-host, Marie Michelle.
That's me.
1 to 4 p.m. Saturdays. Don't miss it on 91.5 WMFO in Medford.
Captured it just before the singing. That was Yours Is No Disgrace by Yes, the intro only. This is WMFO. This is Acoustic Sailing. Welcome. It's 4:03 and the show is going to begin in a matter of moments. I'm glad you're listening. It's a very special Acoustic Sailing. We have Jeff Melnick on the show and he's going to talk about his book entitled Creepy Crawling. But I'm going to play a PSA. And we're going to get on with the show. So stick around. It's a lot of fun stuff happening on this show. Check it out. We'll be right back in a moment.
Why is Connor having trouble focusing in school?
Having trouble finding Connor's middle school? Would you like directions?
No. Why is Connor having trouble focusing in school?
Finding lowest airfare to Istanbul.
No, I'm tired of fighting with him over homework.
Home, walk, restaurant. Need a review?
No, I need help. He's very smart, but his mind wanders. He's disorganized.
I think I understand.
Oh, good.
Finding best potatoes for French fries.
No!
Russet, fingerling, Yukon gold.
Why don't you understand me?
Sorry, I was trying to show how Connor feels every day. Frustrating, isn't it? Redirecting to understood.org.
For the 1 in 5 kids with learning and attention issues, this is what life can feel like. Explore understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues, designed to help your child thrive in school and in life. Understood.org, because understanding is everything.
Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
And you folks right here on WMFO in Medford. And today's Acoustic Sailing, I will be playing some music mainly focused on the year 1969, because it was 49 years ago Charles Manson did his dirty work in Los Angeles. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all kinds of things. And let's get on with it, shall we? Here we go. Jeff Melnick wrote a book called Creepy Crawling. Also, the other title is Charles Manson and the Many Lives of America's Most Infamous Family. And we have him here right in the studio. And Jeff, welcome to WMFO.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
So we're going to talk about the book, and we will go over a lot of the things about Charles Manson. We'll be talking about the family, but it's not necessarily just the facts or the what happened 49 years ago in California. We're going to talk about how Charles Manson, the idea of who he is, his legacy, as you will, how it's still in our consciousness, and how he's perceived. And for an overview, I'm going to have Jeff talk for a moment about what he wanted to accomplish with Creepy Crawling and what the book is about. Go ahead, Jeff.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Ben, you've set it up nicely. I mean, the whole point of the book is to try to get at why we can't get done with the Manson family. There's this whole kind of dominant story about Manson that the murders in August of 1969 ended the 1960s. You find that everywhere. That's in, you know, Vince Bugliosi's book, Helter Skelter. It's in Journalism by Joan Didion. It's in Rock Criticism by Grail Marcus. It's all over the place. This idea that these handful of admittedly terrible murders at the end of 1969 or second half of 1969 somehow contributed to the end of everything experimental, wonderful, innovative about the counterculture in the 1960s. So that's where I started, from this idea that somehow one set of, or two sets of murders could end the 1960s. Not the race riots, not the Vietnam War, not the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy, but somehow there's something emblematic about these murders that ended the 1960s. So that's where I started from. And then I began collecting up everything I could about the murders, about the family. I started that maybe 8 years ago. And it took a number of years just to see what I brought in the net. And it's everything. It's punk rock music, it's hip hop music, it's detective novels, it's art films, it's photography, it's other visual arts, it's after school specials, it's documentaries. So what I try to do in the book is sort of say, how did we get so obsessed with the Manson family? What is it doing for us, to us, on our behalf? That's the goal of the book, is to sort of sort through the cultural meanings of the family.
And you do a fine job. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I found it very fascinating how, even though Barney Hoskins wrote that Jeff's book's a sobering corrective to the apocalyptic hysteria surrounding the hippie horrors of Manson's family, this rigorous recontextualization of time and place forces us to understand the killings in a new way. And yet, in the book, you comment on how Barney Hoskins is one of those people who said that the 60s ended when Charles Manson did his dirty work.
Barney was dear to give the blurb, even though he's one of the folks who I identify as. And it was great. You know, he's a fantastic historian, critic, biographer. His recent book on the town of Woodstock and all the activity circling around that place, Van Morrison, the band, Dylan, Todd Rundgren, so many folks up there, is I think one of the great recent books of music history. And Barney is one of those people who kind of joined this dominant narrative that somehow Manson ended, these murders ended the 1960s. And my contention, and it's really just a little bit of changing the perspective to try to open up the question in different ways, that Manson didn't end the 60s, but really started the 70s. And in other words, the murders then became this occasion to talk about who are we now, what was wrong about all those experiments, the free love, the communes, the drug experimentation, the psychedelic rock. it gave a lot of people the chance to say, you know what, we went too far with that. We need to pull back. Mm-hmm. And so I say what Manson then ends up ultimately being is a kind of weapon that we use to discipline the counterculture, to say you went too far, that was too much, that was scary. We need to pull back to more traditional ways of organizing the family, of disciplining teenagers who act badly, and so on.
Yeah, I think some of the things that surprised me about the book is how action-packed, or just how plain full 1969 was. I mean, we landed on the moon. We had Woodstock. We had, of course, the Manson murders. We had Easy Rider. We had
Altamont at the also
Altamont, yeah, the Rolling Stones playing California and all the tragedy there, and a lot of stuff. How a golden era was in quotes ending. The 1970s were beginning. What's that line by Neil Young about? It's in After the Gold Rush. It's literally in the song After the Gold Rush. Is it 1970?
Yeah.
I can't remember, you know.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Mother Nature's on the run in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's one thing. We'll be taking calls in about 15 minutes or so. So hold back a little bit because we want to set the stage. But think about 1969. Think about all the different things that were happening then. Do you want to comment about just that summer, just about the wild 19... Oh, Brian Jones died before Woodstock happened. Right. And but just talk about a little bit about some of the things. I mean, was Sharon Tate a giant star? Or was she was getting to be? Because she was...
No, I mean, she was... I mean,
she was kind of a glamorous woman.
Right. But in retrospect, I think we see that in some ways her career had kind of peaked already. Mm-hmm. She was in a kind of glamorous scene. Was obviously married to the director Roman Polanski, about whom we can say plenty of things. She was in a kind of fast, high activity social scene in Los Angeles. She was friends with, members of the Mamas and the Papas. She was friends with Jay Sebring, you know, who was also murdered that night, who was the hairdresser to the stars. She ran in this very fascinating glam crowd. Not clear where her career was going, in this moment. Obviously, she was very pregnant at the time she was murdered. That's part of the sort of mythology of the murders, is what happened to the fetus and so on. But she is very much, one of the things I track in the book is how much she's at this very intense crossroads of music industry and film industry people that we very often refer to as the new Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
It's younger folks. It's not the old star system. It's not the old studio system. It's this new emerging class of people. You already mentioned Easy Rider, and that's the signature movie of this new class of people. Signature movie, not just because it's about hippies, made by hippies, but also hippies on the soundtrack, and that's really crucial.
Mm-hmm.
The Birds are on the soundtrack. The Holy Modal Rounders are on the soundtrack, right? I mean, these are real freaky people, to use a word that was very much in circulation at the time. So she's not a hippie, she's not a freak, but she comes to stand in a lot of the journalistic accounts of the murder as being part of this kind of edgy LA/Hollywood crowd. You know, about her career, I'll leave that for other folks to talk about. I don't think she was necessarily on track to have a major lead actor kind of career. She'd mostly been in B movies up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
But she was as a cultural figure hugely important.
Okay. One of the things that really, really got to me was the music side of Charles Manson. And a lot of people might not know this, but Charles Manson, when he was a young man, or before he became infamous, he wanted to be a singer-songwriter. He wanted to be a star in his own. And he wrote songs, he sang songs, and he very much tried to get produced and accepted by the rock and roll / pop music world. And I know he spent a lot of time with the Beach Boys, with Brian Wilson and Dennis Wilson, and also he met and was friendly with Neil Young, And you talk a lot about in the book with Terry Melcher. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explore that whole side of it?
Love
and
to,
and
yeah.
We're going to play a song in just a little bit. But if you want to just talk about that,
so,
please,
so
that'd be great.
Let me just track back a tiny bit. You know, Manson had spent most of his life up until the late 60s in prison. He started getting in trouble in the law when he was literally a prepubescent boy. In prison for years and years, out briefly in the late 50s, then back in again. While he's in jail, he learns how to play guitar from Alvin Karpis, Alvin Creepy Karpis, who was also in jail, who had been a member of Mob Barker's gang. So this is this great little bit of trivia about Manson. Learns how to play guitar, also meets a guy in jail named Phil Kaufman. Phil Kaufman comes out of jail, and he's this key he becomes this key figure as, what do I call him? You know, he calls himself a road mangler in his autobiography. He's a road manager. Mm-hmm. He's a booking agent. He's just one of these guys who ends up being really important in the scene. In LA, and he gives Manson this idea that Charlie's got enough talent that he can make it. He can make it in the scene. Manson meets Dennis Wilson, and not I won't get into the details about how he meets Dennis Wilson, the drummer, one of the Wilson brothers from the Beach Boys. Wilson connects him up with Terry Melcher. If Terry's name isn't familiar to you, Terry Melcher's the son of Doris Day. Doris Day, you know, by the late 50s, she's the symbol of sort of white American femininity, sort of, you know, white bread, star, singer, actor, so on. Terry Melcher is, in his own right, a really important musician, and even more than that, a really important music producer. By the late 60s, he's made his name producing, I think most notably, Paul Revere and the Raiders, and then later, the Byrds, but he's all over the surf rock, LA rock scene. Manson goes to audition for him. He has the idea that Terry Melcher is going to be his route in. Terry Melcher hears the audition, later goes out and visits Spahn Ranch, where the Manson family is living as a commune. And it becomes clear to him that Manson's got some raw talent, but isn't ready to really make a record. So Melcher just kind of like distances himself. Melcher, just to keep the record straight here, lived at 10,050 Cielo Drive. Lived there with his then girlfriend, Candace Bergen, another important actor, child of another famous Hollywood figure, Edgar Bergen. They've moved out, but when the murders happen in the second week of August of 1969, the first dominant theory, it's none of this Vincent Bugliosi helter-skelter race war motive stuff. Everyone in Hollywood knows that Manson was looking for Terry Melcher. That's literally the coverage in major newspapers, that Manson was trying to get revenge on Melcher because Melcher wouldn't record him, wouldn't turn him into a star. So that's the basic Manson as musician story.
Okay. The thing that gets me is, and tell me if I'm wrong, one of the very few people who wants or is open to talk about about Charles Manson is Neil Young. Mm-hmm. Would you say he's the most forthright about out of all those people?
Yeah, you're saying it perfectly. I mean, Neil Young, up until our own moment, I mean, Neil had that autobiography of his own a couple of years ago, Waging Heavy Peace, where he still says, you know, if you heard Charlie Manson, then you knew what a great talent he was. And the line that people often quote from Neil Young is, he basically says, if Charlie just had a band, like the band that was with Dylan on Bringing It All Back Home, just kind of a loose but together rock and roll band, he could have really made it. Yeah. Charlie had raw, you know, he says, Charlie wasn't a songwriter, he was a song spewer. Yeah. You know, he's had these songs coming out of him, and he was a real talent.
Yeah.
Neil Young's, you know, he's key in this LA scene in the moment. He's got, you know, he's making important records. Mm-hmm. Just on the Boston front, I'll note that in this era, he's got Robin Lane singing backup for him, at least on one of his records, who then goes on, of course, in Boston to front Robin Lane in the Chartbusters. So she's also talked about knowing Manson at the time, that he's this key figure.
Let's hear a little bit from Neil. This is a Neil Young interview here coming up.
Spooky times. I knew Charlie Manson, so it spooked the hell out of me.
I don't know if you heard that. It was Neil saying.
You call a songwriter.
Yeah, it was Neil Young in the background.
He was like a song spewer.
He spooked the hell out of me. That's Neil Young talking about Charlie Manson. And he's one of the few individuals that really talked about knowing Charles Manson and spending time with him, because Dennis Wilson ran away from him, basically. Mm-hmm. He was very scared.
That's
and
right.
And Brian Wilson didn't understand him. And they both sort of wondered what the heck this guy was all about.
Right. A lot of daylight between Dennis and Brian, though. Because Brian, from the get-go, is like, he doesn't want to have much to do with Manson. He refers to him as that scruffy little guru. Mm-hmm. While Dennis, meanwhile, is giving interviews in the British press saying, I've met this guy, he's a wizard, we're going to record him on the Brother record label.
Right.
You know, he's making all kinds of promises that the other brothers don't want to support.
Exactly.
But Dennis, right, obviously, Dennis gets really scared. He runs away. He makes his manager basically kick Manson and the Manson women out of the house. And he goes to Greg Jacobson, his buddy Greg Jacobson's, goes and lives in his basement for a while. Greg, I interviewed Greg for the book, and he said Dennis truly was frightened. You know, he felt like his children were in danger, he was in danger. Mm-hmm. He felt like Manson had made some veiled threats at him, but he was really clear that he he backed away from this, but for a long time he was making it really clear that he wanted to be sort of Manson's handler. He wanted to help promote Manson's career, and then he got freaked out and sort of ran from that.
Right. And it most interesting at all, I thought, was how Terry Melcher really was going to go all in with Manson if there was enough talent there and enough maybe, I don't know, acceptability or commercialism was there. And he did two runs where he recorded him and spent time with him.
That's right.
And from your book, you imply that he was crossing his fingers that maybe we have something here. But it didn't turn out the way Melcher turned him down.
That's right. It's kind of amazing in retrospect. Melcher gives him as many chances. Melcher's a real pro. Melcher's not Melcher's not a hippie. He's like Hollywood royalty. Mm-hmm. He's got good connect. You know, he's central in the music business. He doesn't need Manson. He's doing this sort of as a favor to Dennis and really to Greg Jacobson, who's a kind of forgotten but crucial figure in all this, who was sort of a Beach Boys hanger-on associate of Terry Melcher. Melcher gives Manson these chances, goes out to Spahn Ranch, hears the family, you know, do their thing, which is this kind of loose round the campfire thing, and then basically says to an associate of his, Mike Deasy, he says, Mike, you're interested in like that kind of anthropological thing. You want to go out and record, you know, Native American tribes. You might like this hippie gang out there, but not in like a professional way, more in like a National Geographic, you know, ethnography kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was really surprised to hear about Melcher going back to him and recording him that second time around, especially.
So the uncomfortable but really important thing to remember here is that Melcher likes the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally at one of the trials, when one of the prosecuting attorneys says to him, like, why'd you stay involved so much? Melcher gave an answer which made it clear that he stayed involved because he liked the young women.
Right.
And so there's this difficult thing to write about, but I try to confront, which is the way that these young women were serving as kind of enticements for people like Greg Jacobson, for people like Terry Melcher. Terry Melcher at one point, according to, I think, very believable reports, asks his girlfriend at the time, Candace Bergen, if one of the young Manson women can move in with them at Cielo Drive. And Candace Bergen basically looked at him and said, move in as what?
Mm-hmm.
And clearly Melcher's interested. You know, the really difficult part from our perspective in this moment, of course, is a lot of these women are what we now consider underage.
Right.
And so there's this whole question of consent and who is looking out for the interests of these young women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The phone lines are open at 855-915-9636. We hope to hear from you. We're going to take a break, and by taking a break, we're going to hear a little Neil Young. So check this out. Neil Young singing about You Know Who in 1974. Is off the album On the Beach. It's Revolution and Blues.
That's why I'm hanging around.
Neil Young right there from On the Beach, Revolution Blues, a song that David Crosby said, you might not want to put that out. You might not want to say those words. You're talking about Charles Manson and all the nasty stuff that went, that happened in 1969. And Neil Young said, no, I'm going to put this out. And he did put it out. Mm-hmm. It's a spooky song, to say the least. Revolution Blues by Neil Young. One of the things I wanted to talk about was, in the music vein, is you got some pushback. There was Van Dyke Parks who didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah, well, I mean,
fascinating.
You were talking before about Neil Young and his willingness to talk about Manson, to appreciate that Manson was an important musician. That, I mean, just to establish the ground a little bit here. Manson freaked out people in the music business.
He did.
In the movie business. And the minute he got arrested, people started backpedaling wildly, fast, to try to say, nah, I didn't really know him. Maybe I met him once. You know, Neil Young acknowledged he was really tied in. Mm-hmm. The Wilson brothers didn't really want that in the official story. Van Dyke Parks, who's a really important musician, arranger, songwriter, worked very closely with Brian Wilson, obviously, and lots of other folks, and also on his own material. When I was working on the research for the book, he's one of those people I wrote to and said, love to ask you a couple questions. He wrote me right back 2 days in a row, same email, basically to say, not only do I not want to talk to you, but it's an idiotic project.
Yeah.
It's been done. Nobody needs to talk about this anymore. Yeah. Which is kind of funny, because if you look at, you know, the sales of Helter Skelter, Vincent Bugliosi's book over the years, you see plenty of people, you know,
still
want to think about this. The number of documentaries, the number of detective novels. So there's the LA music people really got freaked out. Very few of them. That's why I appreciate Neil Young so much. I mean, Neil's crazy in all his own ways, but he's been very willing to say, we need to acknowledge that, and I've gotten, you know, some sort of critical resistance to this idea, but we need to acknowledge that Charlie Manson was at the center of this scene.
Oh yeah,
he wasn't just like a weird freak hanger-on. He was at the center. He was he was right at the crossroads. He knew everybody. He knew the film people. He knew the music people. There's a decent amount of evidence that lots of folks didn't want Manson talking about how connected they were, particularly how connected they were to some of the young women who followed Manson, you know, in Manson's family. So this is the really uncomfortable thing, that when, as a historian, when I look back at the resources we have, I always have to read them very critically, because for every Neil Young, you have 8 or 10 people. John Phillips, terrible guy in his own right.
From the Mamas and Papas,
saying, we didn't really know that guy. Maybe he showed up at one party that I was at, which runs counter to the preponderance of evidence, which says Manson, Bobby Beausoleil, who was a close Manson associate, very much at the center of the countercultural art, music, film scene. Bobby Beausoleil was in a band that Arthur Lee was in from Love a couple years before the murders took place. So these are people really at the center. These are people who, if you went to a club on the Sunset Strip in late 1968 or early first half of 1969, you knew these people. If you were a regular, if you were a regular on the Strip, if you were a regular in Laurel Canyon, if you went to Frank Zappa's house, you know, real hangout, you know, his log cabin, people always refer to it as the log cabin, you knew Manson. You knew the young women who associated with Manson. So that's the Van Dyke Park thing is really interesting. He's not the only person who turned me down, believe me. John Sebastian from the Love and Spoonful, you know, plenty of people didn't want to talk. Some people really wanted to talk. You know, Greg Jacobson was really willing to talk. Bobby Beausoleil himself was really willing to talk about that scene, about the countercultural music scene. But Van Dyke Parks is very emblematic of the kind of people who just said, no more. Draw the line. Not connected. Don't want to talk about it.
Right. I mean, it was a fascinating time. It was a big change in the music scene, which I guess pop/rock music is all about change. I mean, it's one of the fundamental things about rock music. Society was changing. I know that's a cliche, but 1969 especially, a lot of things came to the surface where they collided, and with Manson, it was lethal.
Right, that's right.
And
And a lot of people, too, I mean, that is really, you know, one of the things I'm pushing back against is this idea that a lot of very privileged people then wanted to say, like, okay, get those freaks out of here. They were mm-hmm. fun. That was fun to party, you know, with some of those edgy, marginal people for a year. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted to just sort of expel them.
Right.
And not really acknowledge what part they played in creating this new culture where folks that we would think of, you know, that we might think of now as kind of marginal, freaky, you know, scene followers were really central to the life of L.A., to the film people, the music people, in this moment. And Manson, you know, he had tales to tell, and he had tales to tell that a lot of folks who were, you know, the Peter Fondas, the Dennis Hoppers, they didn't want these stories to get out.
Right. One thing, we'll talk about movies in just a minute, but I was surprised to learn, I didn't know this for a while, I found out fairly recently that Peter Fonda actually wanted to have a singing career of his own. I actually, there's a Where the Action's At, it's a Nuggets LA scene box set, he has a song on it.
On there, yeah.
It's Peter Fonda singing a tune.
Right.
And
I mean, that's the thing about Easy Rider is that's the moment where the line between the music business and the film business clearly gets erased, right? Mm-hmm. Because the soundtrack is you can't have that movie without the soundtrack, without the Byrds, without Dylan, and so on. They paid a lot of money. The budget for according to some accounts, the budget for the music in that movie was higher than the budget for the rest of the filming.
Which is amazing.
Which is amazing. Right. Some folks want to say that was the first time that was the case. I can't track that, but it's an interesting claim to make.
I mean, prior to that, there was a few Beatle movies, Blackboard Jungle, She's Gotta Have It, I believe, is considered a pop rock movie.
Uh-huh.
And not many movies that the modern day music video...
Yeah, right.
Let's face it, Easy Rider was there in 1969, and what they did in that movie was done in 1989 on TV, on MTV, and it became the standard pretty much of music television / music videos.
That's right, and not surprising, Dennis Hopper gets very interested in Manson, visits him in jail, talks for a while, that he's going to be the one who's going to make the Manson, you know, maybe he'll make the Manson movie, and then he says, no, out of respect to my friend Jay Sebring, you know, I have to let this go. And we can talk more about what ends up being the Jay Sebring movie, which is Shampoo in 1975. These folks can't shake it, the Hollywood folks, you know, the Manson connection, the freak connection. They realize they've been a part of this culture, and now they have to sort out what they're going to do about it.
Amazing.
After the murders,
We'll be taking some calls. It's 855-915-9636, and we'd love to hear from you. And we're going to take a break from the chatting and go into this song. It's a song that was out right around 1969, and it's Something in the Air. Remember this one, Jeff?
Oh, I sure do. Thunderclap Newman. Yeah.
Thunderclap Newman.
And you know that it's
We have got to get it together now, and we have Jeff Melnick right now in the studio talking about Charles Manson and Jeff Melnick's book, Creepy Crawling, Charles Manson and the Many Lives of America's Most Infamous Family. The book is out, and it's a true crime book, it says. It's more about, I would say, the historic slash media look,
yeah,
would you say?
Yeah, that true crime label, that's a fight I lost with my my editor. She's like, you got a book about Manson, it's going to say true crime on the inside flap. It's more of a cultural history.
It's a cultural history, that's what I was going to say. And it's out on Arcade Publishing. And it's a brand new book that has just been released. And the cover of the book shows a bunch of family members, I would imagine. I didn't quite see anywhere listing where this photo was. But what is this photo on the cover?
So that the photo is of family members, not Manson himself, but other members of the family at Spahn Ranch, which was, it's in Chatsworth, which is in the San Fernando Valley, officially part of Los Angeles. So that, any of you who have been to L.A. know how weird for an East Coaster L.A. is, because what's considered part of the city seems to us like very East Coasters, very far-flung and out there. So Chatsworth still to this day feels like a very marginal, out there, kind of remote. You know,
is it a canyon or not really?
It's not exactly a canyon, although obviously the canyons are really important. It's part of the valley, part of the San Fernando Valley. So it's there's mountains all around it. And it was this remote place where the family, where there was this old film ranch where they used to film Westerns, Western movies, Western TV shows, that the family sort of took over. They made a deal with the very, very old guy, George Spahn, who owned the ranch, and they made it into a commune, and they helped out around the ranch in all kinds of ways. And that picture I really liked, because it shows the family like they're sort of playing, they're pretending that they're hiding, but they're also kind of scary. And that's that kind of that kind of mixed message I was trying to get at, or that ambivalent image that they were at once just kind of young, dumb people having some fun out in LA, but they also turned into this thing that upset a lot of folks around them. The title, obviously, I'll just quickly say, the title, Creepy Crawling, comes from what they called the main crime that they committed regularly, which involved breaking into homes in and around Los Angeles. Very often, while the owners were sleeping in their bedrooms, they'd go into the house, they'd rearrange the furniture, and then they'd leave. They'd rarely steal anything. So one of the things what really drew me to that for the title was this idea was that the murders are terrible. We need to remember them. We need to talk about them. We need to, obviously, we needed to adjudicate them. You know, we needed to figure out what those murders meant. But that really the way we live with the family is because of this creepy crawling, the way they came into our homes and upset our, you know, they moved our furniture around. They upset our ideas about what a family looks like, about what, you know, young people should be doing, about how you love, about how you eat meals together. And that's one of the things I like about the picture, because they're a family. They work like a family, but they don't look like a mother, father, you know, brother, sister family that you'd see like on Sesame Street.
Right.
You know, it, literally the same year. Yeah.
Well, one thing about in the media, there is films that were very much influenced by the Manson murders and about some of the changing mores of the time. Do you want to comment on some of the films that that perhaps didn't, you know, maybe they weren't focused on the Manson murders, but they were, you know, they came out around the time or shortly after?
Great. So that's a great question. One of the things I worked really hard to do in the book is to figure out, there's all these texts, these histories, these films that are obviously about the family. Ed Sanders' book, The Family, which comes out in the early 1970s. Vincent Bugliosi's True Crime Bible, Helter Skelter, 1974. But then there's all these works that it became clear to me that you couldn't have without the family of the Tate-LaBianca murders and without the Manson family. There's a whole set of horror films I talk about in the book, including Last House on the Left, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, very often films that involve home invasions. And that's one of the things I got really interested in, is how much the realities of what the family did in and around Los Angeles in the late 1960s freaked a lot of people out, made a lot of film directors want to open up this question of, like, what does it mean that our homes, it's supposed to be the place where you go in, you lock the door, you're safe, doesn't feel safe anymore.
Right.
It's not just the Manson family, right? Because it's also the Green Beret murders in early 1970. Jeffrey McDonald's family gets murdered. Mm-hmm. He ultimately gets convicted of those crimes. But his claim is that what happened is that some young people came in chanting, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." Right, that's his story. Right. They were hippies who came in and killed his family. So that's this the question that the family raised is, are our homes safe? Are our children safe? Can we lock the door and feel like, you know, we're okay in our home? So it's the horror movies, and then there's a whole number of, I guess, what you'd call more serious or more arty films like Shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, the Warren Beatty star vehicle.
And that was in the early 1970s,
that's right? 74, so yeah. That, or 75. So there's a cluster of movies around 74, 75, right around the time that Bugliosi's big book comes out, that are either about L.A., about the emerging Hollywood culture, about changes that were wrought by the counterculture. Shampoo, if folks have seen it, you know it's about this fast scene in and around Los Angeles. But it's also about Nixon. It's also about what his election in 1968 meant. It's also about how much his rise to power freaked people out about how much freedom was safe to express, how much you were allowed to try new things. Warren Beatty, in that movie, he's based on Jay Sebring, who's the Hollywood hairdresser I mentioned, who was also killed at Cielo Drive. But he's an establishment guy in a lot of ways. He wants to just have things his way. He wants to make a lot of money. He wants to be involved with a lot of women. And so the question, it's this whole question of how far can you go?
Mm-hmm.
How far is too far? That's this question that the Manson murders keep raising for the dominant culture is, can you experiment with new modes of sexual relations, with drug taking, with partying, you know, with just this whole world of non-mainstream socializing? So Shampoo is one of those movies I really try to take on as being in this. It's not about the Manson family. It's not about the Manson murders, but it's unthinkable that anybody would have made it without that in front of it.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's I found interesting, and you do talk about Easy Rider, and Easy Rider came out, I believe, shortly before August, a month before?
A couple months before.
Right around June of 1969, two months before the Manson murders. And it's very interesting. Two films that I don't believe you comment, I didn't notice it in the book at all, but is very much around the time. Like, Easy Rider touches on life in a commune.
Yeah.
And the possibility of living that life, and the possibility of checking out, or, you know, easily or simply going through it.
That's right.
One book you didn't mention that I was surprised, or I didn't notice, it was Alice's Restaurant.
Uh-huh, right.
And that book also comments on, you know, or you know, makes it clear that, wait, this commune living isn't just fun and games. I mean, people can get hurt, people can... You know, maybe it's not the way.
That's right.
And, you know, one of the characters says, well, let's just get out of Massachusetts. It'll be better in Vermont.
Right.
Leaving Alice even more sad of like, no one understanding where she's at. And the final shot of her questioning the whole lifestyle, that commune lifestyle. Right. In 1969 was I think Alice's Restaurant was 68, I believe. I'd have to look it up, but it was right around that time period. And then Easy Rider also has a questioning, you know, the famous Peter Fonda saying, "We blew it."
Right.
You know, is it we blew it because, you know, what we did wasn't great, what we saw wasn't great, what we, you know, we did take part of, didn't take part of, wasn't great. It's very unclear that the, in quotes, hippie dream, is what's not unclear, I should say, is the hippie dream is not, you know, rubber stamp, like, this is the way to live your life, this is wonderful, you know, three cheers for it. It's very much like, is this the way to live? Is this a good thing? Society's changing.
Right.
And, you know, let's, you know, walk slowly here.
That's right. That's,
you know,
right. And yeah, absolutely. And those are great examples. Bonnie and Clyde, I also don't write about, is another great example of it's 1930s, you know, outlaws, but there's a way to read that movie as an allegory of what does it mean to be a marginal figure in the culture? What does it mean to rebel against the dominant culture? Will you die in, you know, a flurry of bullets, as obviously Bonnie and Clyde. Right. So there are all these movies, Straw Dogs later on, you know, I would guess and say 1971.
It was early 70s, for sure. Yeah.
You know, again, that question of, like, ultra-violence, who's in charge, who's controlling the culture, things just seem to be flying out of control. So I'm with you. I think that's a really great example. Yeah.
One other book, it's a book slash movie, and I saw the movie. I didn't read the book, but I saw the movie. It's called My Side of the Mountain. And if you ever check that out, it's all about a little kid who decides to go and do the Henry Thoreau thing.
Right.
And the movie, I don't know how the book, how it plays out in the book, but the movie basically makes it clear that the parents are not only not interested in the kid, not interested in the kid's life, don't really factor in, but it's really strange how independent and how strong this young person is, and they strike off on their own and go into nature.
Right.
And that movie was in right around that time period, and it's fascinating. You see that movie today, and the first thing you think of is, like, where are the parents?
Right.
How could this kid so completely disown his family and walk away?
All right, so
fascinating.
So that's great. And if I get to do the second edition, I'm gonna have to look at that one for the new epilogue, because that's very much what I'm trying to get at is how many people were talking about in the wake of the Manson murders, and I say very much because of the Manson murders. You know, the old PSA on television, it's 10 o'clock, do you know where your children are, right? I mean, that starts in the mid-1970s, and it very much captures this idea. You know, in the book, I write a lot about the movies, after-school specials, novels, short, you know, young adult novels about runaways. And that's something that is this really uncomfortable truth in and around our discussion of the Manson family is, how did all these young people end up out there?
Mm-hmm.
What was wrong with their families of origin?
Right.
There are some terrible stories there. We know those stories now because we have enough great, you know, historical work, biography, journalism, and so on about Lynette Fromm, about Susan Atkins. You know, we have clear data that these young women came from what today we would call very dysfunctional families, right? There's all these, you know, runaway movies, runaway songs, Art Linkletter, you know, he does the one with his daughter, Call Collect, I'm getting the title wrong, but, you know, Call Collect, you know, we want you to come home. Also clearly in this framework of the children are on the run, right? It's not the romantic, heroic narrative of Easy Rider. It's not two grown men getting on a motorcycle saying, let's see the country, I'm Captain America.
Right, I'm free. Right? I'm free. I can do what I want.
This is vulnerable young women. A lot of the conventional version of this narrative that develops is the young women end up on the street.
Mm-hmm.
They end up vulnerable to being exploited as sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
They end up in communes where they're not literally sex workers, but they're clearly vulnerable, you know, in terms of their sexuality. That's key to this story.
I almost wonder if in 67, 68, when so many people went to San Francisco, and San Francisco got overrun with young people, and they literally said, leave us.
That's right.
If somehow that message didn't get across until 69, and people didn't actually know about, you know, go back,
right,
then they were going still heading west.
Right.
They were still going into L.A.
and
into California.
And not just L.A., but to the East Village in New York,
yeah,
and to various other sites of sort of countercultural activity. You know, George Harrison goes to the Hate.
Oh, I'm fascinated.
You know,
yes,
right,
yes.
in 68, and he walks around and says, this is what? I mean, he's just kind of like, in that great British way, he's just kind of like, this is the hippie dream. This is bad. Stop,
this is drug addiction. This is alcoholism. This is nowhere. This is not artistic. It's not creative.
Right.
It's not spiritual.
Right.
And
members of the counterculture
runs away from it.
Members of the counterculture are trying to keep up with this. They're forming free clinics. They're forming, you know, settlement houses here in Boston. You know, a dear colleague of mine, Judy Smith, was involved with one of the settlement youth houses, Huckleberry House, you know, named for Huckleberry Finn, another famous runaway, of course, right?
Yep.
So Boston is really facing this crisis too. There's all these young people who are drawn here because it's a college town, because it seems like, you know, a good place to sort of find yourself, to find other people like you, and a lot of these folks end up on the street. They end up exploited. They end up in danger.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a pretty picture. Yeah.
We're going to play a song now. The song was a 1969 song. It was a big hit. You don't hear this particular one much. It's about a California town. And we're going to finish up the first hour of Acoustic Sailing. And we're going to continue talking to Jeff Melnick about his book, Creepy Crawling. And I hope to hear from you in the second hour. Again, the number is 855-915-9636. So we'll be back in a few. Enjoy. This tune, probably haven't heard this one in quite a while. 1969.
Just about a year ago, I set out on the road, seeking my fame and fortune, looking for a pot of gold. Things got bad and things got worse, I guess you know the tune.
Again, the song was a top 10 hit in 1969, and of course, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and great music, and what a strange time that was. 1969, we're talking about Charles Manson and the Manson family, and we have Jeffrey Melnick with his book Creepy Crawling, Charles Manson and the Many Lives of America's Most Infamous Family. Jeff Melnick, welcome back. And before we go on, let me give the station ID. This is WMFO in Medford. This show will be on the air. We're on for another hour, and it'll be at WMFO.org for the next 2 weeks if you want to go and check it out and listen to it again and again and again. Jeff, we talked about music, we talked about films, and we have a caller, the first caller. Roland, you are on the air with Jeff Melnick.
Hey, Vin. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Roland.
Hey, yeah, this book really looks interesting. I'm definitely going to check it out. Thanks for doing the show. I noticed you were talking earlier about Manson, the musician, basically, and the fact that he was essentially... He worked with some pretty famous people, mm-hmm. Even though his success was ultimately, you know, pretty limited. What baffled me is that the Beach Boys actually did steal one of his songs.
That's right.
He had a demo called Cease to Exist, and it was on the flip side of, I think it was Bluebirds Over the Mountain single.
Yep.
in 68, they actually put a flip side called Never Learn Not to Love, which was credited to Dennis Wilson. And, you know, I always wondered if, you know, Manson actually had some reason to feel like he was, you know, kind of, you know, not handled well, I guess,